Welcome to the Commonweal Policy Podcast with me, Jonathan Chaffee, the Campaigns Officer here at Commonweal, and delighted as ever to be joined by Dr. Craig DL. This is the second of our episodes focusing on the coronavirus and its various consequences. Welcome, Craig, to the show.
Hello. How are you handling on lockdown?
Not bad. Finding, and I'm sure you'll be the same, but finding actually that I'm busier than ever. We've got so much on at Commonweal, a big agenda and work programme that we're all working towards. And outside of that, lots of writing and taking calls from people and discussing with people, not just in Scotland, but actually across the world, using Zoom and so on. The same for you, busy?
Oh yeah, I've been talking to all kinds of groups all over Scotland, including several today, about upcoming Commonweal projects that I'll hopefully be able to talk about a bit more in the coming weeks and months.
Excellent, and we'll use this podcast, of course, to talk about some of those upcoming initiatives. What we wanted to do when it came to how we're covering the coronavirus, and as I said at the very top of the programme, its various consequences, is to try and break down each podcast into one element or other, and do some analysis on it, because this is just such a huge paradigm-shifting, earth-shattering moment in not just the history of capitalism, but indeed the whole of human history. These are momentous times. We know that disease and virus have played important parts throughout the history of the human story, and they've led to all kinds of consequences. So big topic, but this week we're going to focus in particular on trade, and we're going to have a discussion about the impact that coronavirus is having on trade and on globalization. Globalization, of course, already is suffering a slowdown in various ways, which we can get into. Before we get into that, I know that listeners will want to know your general view about where you think the economy is going. Half the stuff I read is saying that there's going to be a global depression, the like of which we haven't seen. There are other economic analysts who say that they're expecting the economy to bounce back in a much stronger way than people might imagine. What's your general view?
Yeah, I mean, I've seen a lot of economists taking the extremely optimistic view, calling this a so-called V-shaped recession, by which they mean that the economy has been turned off as part of the lockdown and quarantine measures. And when we lift them, we can just turn the economy back on again and everything will run exactly as it was before. Let's just say I have a few issues with this. I'm actually going to be exploring this topic on our Commonweal sister site Source with a series of articles looking at the impact on the Scottish economy going through the first tomorrow, actually just laying out the overall picture, and then over the coming days and weeks going into each of the sectors in the Scottish economy, like with the impact on our agricultural sector, the impact on commercial, the impact on tourism, and running through where the impacts are hitting hardest and where it might be harder to bounce back from, and what perhaps we need to do to either help sectors recover or help sectors reform.
Well, that's a very useful start, and we'll look forward to reading your articles on Source very much. So let's get into the meat of today's episode. I want to talk to you about trade. I want to talk to you about globalization. Can we just start by, let's just have you give a bit of an assessment or an overview of some of the key issues here involved in this discussion.
Yeah, well, the paradigm up till now has been one of globalization, of ever freer trade. And free trade is generally a good thing. You do want to be able to see goods and services and people being able to cross borders with as little difficulty as possible. But we've also seen pressures on these. We've seen the downsides of globalization, as money is able to flow across borders more and more freely, then it often means that countries end up undercutting each other on jobs, and that helps depress wages. It's not people coming to your country that depresses wages, it's the jobs leaving that depresses wages. And we've seen more recently, as part of this pandemic, that the people most in favour of free trade suddenly become very protectionist when they need necessary supplies that everybody else also needs. We've seen some fairly horrible stories come out across the world in the past few days and weeks. In Scotland, in the past few days, we saw the story running for a couple of days on a story that was quite murky for a while and seems to have cleared up on companies that were supplying personal protection equipment to healthcare being told or saying that that Public Health England had told them not to supply goods to anywhere outside of England. And this kicked off an argument at the Scottish and UK government level. It seems to have been cleared up now. We're not entirely sure if the order was given or was not given. But it does seem that the assurances have been given that this will not happen, and that the companies involved have come out and said, right, okay, we are going to be happy to supply equipment cross-border. But the fact that this happened, the fact that this argument happened, brings to light, you know, a small part of what's happening across the world. When everybody needs something that is now so critical, like PPE, and everyone's scrabbling to get limited supplies of it, then relationships across borders particularly can become quite fraught. We've seen even worse places like Trump's America, and America has been outright ordering American domiciled but multinational companies not just to stop selling to other countries, but actually requisitioning shipments that were bound for other countries. It's happened to Germany a couple of times. There's been accusations that it's happened to Canada. So America is just, I mean, that's an act of piracy, is it not? Just outright diverting supplies. And if this keeps going and this gets worse, then, you know, we face a real risk that this kind of thing can become more commonplace and a lot worse.
Well, that's I think, a very useful outline of the situation. I thought that the American example was, in particular, very interesting, because globalization, as we've understood it, is in fact a reflection of American power in the world. In a sense, globalization doesn't exist without there being American hegemony, at least the globalization that we've known. And to have the American state go so fundamentally against the logic of the free market, quote unquote, is quite a stunning development, because that is exactly what's happened. So globalization is clearly beginning to break down, and in particular the kind of corporate neoliberal globalization that we've all known. And this, of course, is on the back of already existing issues in the global economy when it comes to trade, even before the coronavirus. I don't know if you want to say a little bit about some of the underlying tendencies here, which could become even more magnified, amplified as a result of the virus itself.
Well, you have seen governments start to threaten other countries with things like trade barriers and outright trade wars. Again, Donald Trump is the front person in a lot of this. His entire trade strategy seems to be throw on some tariffs, threaten to throw on more, and keep doing it until the other side backs down. And when they back down, do it a bit more so you can squeeze even more concessions from them. He's not someone who particularly believes in mutually beneficial deals. It's just a case of, if he can't see how he's screwing you over, you must be screwing him over, and he can't see it yet, and that makes him angry.
Indeed. This, of course, is having huge repercussions geopolitically. There's been so much said about the role of America in the present situation, the role of China, and in fact the role of the European Union, which is what I want to now come on to. Do you have any comments then, just taking your kind of initial analysis and kind of applying it in particular to the Eurozone? Because it seems to me that there's a real crisis developing there. Let's be clear that there had been a crisis developing there for some time, but it seemed to have been stabilised somewhat just in the months running up to the coronavirus hitting. But now there's a real fraying and a real tension. Do you want to kind of unravel some of that?
Yeah, well, the tension has always been there within the Eurozone. You have the richer exporting countries, chiefly Germany, who have really been sort of pooling money towards themselves. They export goods, that means money gets sent into Germany. But then you've got the other countries who are buying those goods, and a lot of them are in the south of the Eurozone. That money is leaving their countries, and they can't really compete on the export market because they can't compete on German manufacture and German quality because they don't have the production lines there to do that. But they also can't compete on price because they can't do what they did pre-Eurozone and devalue their currencies. Compounding that now, what you have is a pandemic that isn't being spread equally across the Eurozone. The major hotspots of it are in those poorer countries, in Italy and Spain. So it's kind of amplifying the tensions that were already there within the Eurozone. How the EU reacts to this will determine, you know, what happens with that. I think they have been relatively good at getting to grips with what happened. They have been good at trying to keep cross-border cooperation going. They have been slow at getting money moving, though. They've been slow at pushing out bonds to try and pay for more treatments and more equipment. Possibly they're doing better than the UK, but that's a different question, a different topic slightly. It's still uncertain. It's still uncertain how things will go, because we are in the middle of this. And while there are glimmers of hope, places like Italy and Spain are rolling over. They may have reached their peak. We're still far from the end of the tunnel on this, and the repercussions will be felt for years and decades.
Now, we've of course debated things like the EU in the past, where you and I have taken different views on some of the issues that have been raised around the European Union. But I think we also have a lot of agreement when it comes to the injustice that's located in global trade. Yeah. And I think we've got an agreement that the institutions that run global trade are run in a manner which drives wealth into a small section of the world population that has led to all kinds of economic damaging economic consequences for the global south, for example. And that's before we get to the question of the environment and of the planet and the way in which trade and global supply chains impact that. So now we're looking at a new world emerging. And I'd like to kind of move us on to some of the ideas that are being developed around alternative ways to look at world trade and alternative ideas of how we might do this. Now, Commonweal, I know, has produced a paper on trade. And I just wonder if you would like to make any reflections on this matter, on that, and on how that might apply itself to the kind of unfolding situation that we see today.
It's maybe good to first start by talking about the UK's kind of approach to trade so far.
Sure.
If we remember back at the start of March, back in that dim and the ancient past, now we talked about these recessions being sort of singularity moments in economic and political thinking. You know, we're not going back to normal. We're going into a different phase. The 2019 and even the start of 2020 is as distant a world to now as 2006 was to 2008. If you think about it that way. But I remember back at the start of March seeing a report that was talking about a government advisor, quite a high-placed government advisor in the UK government, advocating that the UK should stop producing food, just cut agriculture to zero, because the overall GDP of agriculture was only about 1% of the total GDP of the UK. So we didn't need food. We can just focus all that energy on something more productive, like finance, and we'll just buy in all the food that we need. We can become like Singapore, import all of our food, we'll have plenty of money to buy it, it'll be fine. Less than a month later, you know, we're faced with headlines of the UK commissioning charter flights to bring in folk from Eastern Europe to help pick fruit, because if we don't, that fruit is going to rot in the vines, rot in the bushes. And we are seeing stories around the world now that because of the disruptions of global supply chains, because of the lockdowns, and because of the changes in eating patterns, we're not eating in restaurants now, we're eating more at home, we could be faced with a real possibility of, in the months and maybe a year to come, that we could be looking at headlines on one channel of food rotting in the fields, and on the other channel of massive lines at food banks because people can't get food.
Yeah.
Because the supply chains are all disrupted.
Which is a completely, sorry to jump in, but I mean, that's just a completely insane circumstance, isn't it? We have all of this food being produced and not going anywhere, and you have all these people needing food.
And we'll see the same in other sectors, although it's a bit less critical if you have a warehouse full of iPhones and nobody being able to buy iPhones. It's not quite the same magnitude of problem, even if it's the same type of problem. So we are going to have to come out of this pandemic looking at ways that we can really start thinking strategically about our trade. We can't rely on supply chains being open all the time anymore, not just because of pandemics, but also because of people like Donald Trump playing the trade war game. So we might have to start thinking about more robust, more resilient economics. This is something that Commonweal is going to be talking about a lot over the next several weeks and months. How do we create a resilient economics model for Scotland? Part of that will be looking at increasing domestic production of critical goods that, you know, if the borders go up somewhere, we're not cut off. Some of it might be to look at more stockpiling of goods, like, you know, PPE for healthcare. We might have to start thinking about where we get our goods from. And if we're getting goods or resources from unstable parts of the country, how can we help to stabilize those parts of the world? Or how can we source them from other places so that we can maintain those supply lines? We can't just take these things for granted anymore.
So just to for the listeners, I just want to be really clear about something, which is, even when you say the word resilience, can you just like break down a little bit what we actually mean by that? Because I think that's important that we get that understood at the outset.
Well, the thing to remember is this pandemic that is affecting us so badly right now isn't the only crisis that's coming down our way. As soon you know, we sort this, we have to face up to the fact that we have a climate emergency. It hasn't gone away. It's still looming. It's still coming down on us. So all this disruption that's happening to the economy, you know, if we just go back to normal and maintain all of the same weaknesses that we had before, the next crisis that comes along could be even bigger and hit even harder, and may not be possible to recover from that one. So when we're talking about resilient economics, we're talking about, you know, where are the weaknesses in our economies and what are the threats to our economies, and what do we need to do to sort them? How do we avoid going back to normal and instead reform into something better?
So that's, of course, a big agenda, a big lot of work, which I know that you and others in Commonweal are presently working on. It seems to me that this is really an idea whose time has come, because you look at the need for us to develop sustainable food systems, for example. for us to develop the means to produce goods and services which we might need in any number of the myriad of crises that we might face moving into the latter parts of this century, then that work needs to start now. In fact, it needed to start many decades ago. Yeah. Let's be honest about this. Now, it seems to me, and this is where I want to kind of come to some conclusion, look, everything that you've said today, I think has been said by quite a lot of people now who are coming to grips with the idea that, you know, we do need alternatives to globalisation. We do need new ways of conducting trade. All of these kind of big questions. But I wonder, and I do worry, that the political leaders are not up to speed on this at all. I can well imagine, for example, the present SNP leadership, attempting to resuscitate the kind of failed model of globalisation that has got us to this point. I can see this happening across Europe. I can see it happening in many different countries. And therefore, there does need to be an extended political challenge here that manages to raise the kind of conversation and the level of the political debate around this, so that we don't just attempt to revert back to quote unquote normal, when we know that normal is not going to offer us the strategies or the resources or the protection that is going to be needed as we move into the 21st century. Do you have any comment on that and how you think that we can build the kind of movement that we're going to need to deliver some of the objectives which you've started to outline?
There's going to be a strong pressure or a strong temptation from politicians to spend the next several years doing that, get back to normal, rebuild what we had idea.
Yeah.
The responses might end up being similar to the responses that were created during the 2008 financial crisis. The thing to remember there is it took us about a decade to get back to normal. It was the global economy had finally just about settled out about 2018, 2019, and then this has come along. As I say, the climate emergency is a decade away before it becomes irreversible. We simply do not have time to spend even one parliamentary session going back to normal and then thinking about reform. So when a politician gets up and says, yeah, but the real crisis is now, we need to fix this, then we will think about something else. No, we need to fix this by thinking about something else. We simply don't have time to do otherwise.
Yeah, I mean, it just brings to mind, just to example of where we need to do things differently. I know I've looked at this coronavirus and discussed with many people, and they have reflected something which I think lots of us will have been trying to process, which is that in a sense this is a kind of snapshot of what climate breakdown will do.
Yeah.
In terms of how it will disrupt economic activity and so on. And it made me think of a programme for government where there was an outline of how Scotland's green and renewable assets will be effectively sold off. You know, there's a portfolio of £3 billion of green assets in Scotland that will be sold off to international investors, global investors. That, it seems to me, is one example of, I'm sure, many, but one example where we'd have to do things far differently. Do you agree with that?
Absolutely. I mean, the case for domestic investment right now has never been better. I mean, interest rates have hit the floor as part of the emergency package. And that's even taking account of historically low rates before that. It is cheaper than free for governments to borrow right now, but investment rates are below inflation rates. So we really need to be building up, accelerating the building up of programmes like the Scottish National Investment Bank. It needs to have the powers, we've written about this several times, the Scottish Government needs to lobby strongly the UK Government to give SNB the powers to be able to do the borrowing that it needs to be able to do to lift the caps imposed on it by arbitrary Treasury rules that the Chancellor of the Exchequer at the UK has already said he's going to review to free up the money to start investing. Rather than selling off Scotland's assets, we should be building them up.
I mean, I think that's very succinctly put. And, you know, Commonwealth is going to be at the forefront of making sure this happens. And we've got a big task ahead of us. One of the things that we'll do is leave a link in the section below this podcast where you can actually sign up to become a volunteer. We're recruiting hundreds and we want to recruit thousands of people right across the country to sign up, become a volunteer, get involved in Commonwealth so that we can develop a movement around the policy platform that is presently being developed that will help us to rebuild and rebuild in a way that puts both people and planet first. So please do sign up for that. We want to really do something quite big and with big impact. And we think that we can do that. Not only we can do that, indeed, there's no real option at this point other than to campaign like we've never campaigned before, given the circumstances. No, just to bring this podcast to a close, I do think it's important that in each of our episodes on the coronavirus that while we talk about the big economic and social and political issues, we can't forget the very real human cost, which is currently affecting individuals and families up and down the country and right across the world. You know, I think it's important that we register that. Craig, how are you navigating the situation personally? I know that you were affected health-wise and so on. So, you know, how are you finding the situation personally?
I was very lucky. I managed to contract a mild case. I have now more or less fully recovered. Had a little bit of a wobble at the tail end of last week, but that was my own fault. Commonwealth's so busy, we're producing so much stuff. I ended up writing a policy paper over the course of a day and a half and put myself back in bed for a day afterwards. This is not how people should work. Please, I'll try and start following my own advice from now on. But I'm perfectly good just now. My family are still okay. I am worried about my mum, who is on the shielding list through health reasons, and she's worried, she's anxious. So I'm making sure we keep checking in with her and with my other family members. Just to reiterate, I don't like this phrase social distancing that we've been using. I know why it's developed, I know why it's there. I don't like it. We need physical distancing at times like this, but we need more social solidarity. So folks, you know, phone your mum, phone your family, phone your friends, keep in touch. It's how we will get through this as a society.
And that's a good note to end on, because we'll also just leave a link to our solidarity page where we are collecting and going to be curating all of the examples of solidarity that have been displayed. And I think actually to end on a hopeful note, in a deep crisis like this, many predict a kind of Mad Max scenario emerging. I think in fact what we've seen is a great coming together of ordinary folk and a deep gratitude to public service and to putting the society and the needs of the society ahead of ourselves as individuals. And that really is quite an important break with what we've been trained to think and trained to behave yeah. Like. So there's a great wider process that's taking place here in amongst the horror and the tragedy and the destruction. We'll do all that we can to make sure that in the end we come out of this with a more positive society than we have had over the recent decades. And on that, Craig, any last comments from yourself?
Only to remind folk that the real lesson of the Mad Max films is that community beat dictators every time.
Well, exactly. And on that note, we'll leave you to get on with whatever you're doing to get yourself through the lockdown. Thank you very much for tuning in. We appreciate everyone who listens. Get in contact with us if you have any questions, if you have any issues that you'd like to raise with us and have discussed on the podcast. Everyone here at Commonweal is working hard, as we keep saying. We send our solidarity to everyone who's tuned in and wish you the best possible days ahead as we get through this lockdown. Until next week, we will be working on our programme that we've set out, and we'll be communicating that through our email lists and on our website. And on that basis, we'll speak to you next week.